In 1892, Edvard Munch, the Norwegian impressionist artist, was on a walk outside a hill in Oslo, and he had an experience while on that walk that he came back to his home and wrote in his diary and eventually made a poem out of that experience. And the poem, translated into English, went like this. I was walking along the road with two friends. The sun was setting. Suddenly the sky turned blood red. I paused, feeling exhausted, and leaned on the fence. There was blood and tongues of fire above the blue-black fjord and the city. My friends walked on, and I stood there trembling with anxiety, and I sensed an infinite scream passing through nature. It was that experience that inspired one of the most famous paintings in modern history. In the German, or rather in Norwegian, the name of the poem was called, or the name of the painting was called Skrik, from which you and I get the word shriek. But the painting that we've all come to know, the painting that's on the front of your bulletin, was originally or finally translated in English, Scream. Munch did this black and white lithograph of that same painting in 1895, but the original pastel on cardboard sold in 2012 for $119 million. Why would something like this become so celebrated? Why would it be so cherished? Why would it be seen as one of those seminal works of art in the modern era? This particular scene in the painting is from an area in Oslo where there are two things that are not far from one another, a slaughterhouse and a lunatic asylum. And some have wondered if the feeling that Munch got was because he could hear the shrieks from both places, which would give anyone pause about the way the world is. And yet, I think the reason this painting has persisted in our collective memory is that he has captured an undercurrent of the human condition. He has found that way to express the anxiety that we perhaps feel about who we are and where we are. Now, in an earlier day, though it may be a little bit oversimplistic to say so, in order to relieve that anxiety, people would try to find God. In our day, it's more common for people to relieve that anxiety by finding ourselves. And it goes something like this in our logic. If only we find out who we are, what we're made of, what we're here for, if only the world knows who we are and takes us on our terms, then everything will be well and our anxiety will be dispelled. Whether there's a God or not is not nearly as important as we know who we are and that we have a self. That's kind of where the collective logic of our day goes. For the season of Lent that began this week on Wednesday, we're going to take a look at several statements that all have one thing in common. They all begin with Jesus saying, I am. They're all about self-attestations of himself that are going to give us a sense, a way, a path into how he understood himself, into his identity. And so that you and I might get a grasp of why we think that's important in case you needed another impetus for wanting to listen to these sermons, I'm taking one of my cues, my angle into this whole series from something that C.S. Lewis said, which is on the front of your bulletin, at which point I'm going to read only the first sentence to get us started. He said in that last chapter of Mere Christianity, until you have given up yourself to him, you will not have a real self. That's bold. And if that ain't countercultural, I don't know what is. Lewis's contention is that you will not find out who you are. You will not find yourself until you find it in his self. Through what his self tells you about yourself. And Jesus, in all of these I statements, are implicitly making the same case. And so this morning, we're going to look at one I am statement that has the arguable distinction of juxtaposing some of the most endearing and scandalizing words that Jesus perhaps ever spoke. And they're all going to speak of his authority. Authority that you and I are not merely called to acknowledge. It's actually an authority that you and I are called to take refuge in, to take cover in. An identity that's going to help us take cover against the three main sources of what causes us to inwardly scream. What are those three things? The enslavement of sin, the lies of the devil, and the fear of death. It's from those things that we take cover in Jesus' identity. So, would you stand? We're in John chapter 8, starting in verse 31. John 8, starting in verse 31. So Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, "If you abide in my word, you're truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." They answered him, "We're offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free?" And Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The Son remains forever. So if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. I know that you're offspring of Abraham, yet you seek to kill me because my word finds no place in you. I speak of what I have seen with my father, and you do what you have heard from your father." And they answered him, "Abraham is our father." Jesus said to them, "If you were Abraham's children, you would be doing the works Abraham did. But now you seek to kill me, a man who has told you the truth that I heard from God. This is not what Abraham did. You're doing the works your father did." And they said to him, "We were not born of sexual immorality. We have one father, even God." And Jesus said to them, "If God were your father, you would love me. For I came from God and I am here. I came not of my own accord, but he sent me. Why do you not understand what I say? It's because you cannot bear to hear my word. You are of your father, the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning and has nothing to do with truth, because there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he is a liar and the father of lies. But because I tell the truth, you don't believe me. Which one of you convicts me of sin? If I tell the truth, why don't you believe me? Whoever is of God hears the words of God. The reason why you do not hear them is that you're not of God." And the Jews answered him, "Are we not right in saying that you're a Samaritan and have a demon?" And Jesus answered, "I don't have a demon, but I honor my Father, and you dishonor me. Yet I do not seek my own glory. There is one who seeks it. He is the judge. Truly I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death." And the Jews said to him, "Now we know that you have a demon. Abraham died, as did the prophets. Yet you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death. Are you greater than our father Abraham, who died and the prophets died? Who do you make yourself out to be?" And Jesus answered, "If I glorify myself, my glory is nothing. It's my Father who glorifies me, of whom you say he is our God. But you've not known him. I know him. If I were to say that I do not know him, I would be a liar like you. But I do know him and I keep his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day. He saw it and was glad." And so the Jews said to him, "You're not yet 50 years old and you've seen Abraham?" And Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am." And so they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. If you're ever going to read the Gospel of John, you should start by reading chapter 20, verse 31, because he's going to tell you why he wrote the book from the very beginning. The reason he wrote that book, he says, is, quote, "These are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." That's his purpose, to make a case for the identity of Jesus, who would bring God's will to reality like no one ever had or would. And in making that case, he's inviting everyone who would consider that case both to believe in him and thereby to find what we all want. We all want life. We want life that lives, to put it in a way. We want life that walks with wisdom. We want life that both celebrates its joys and does not crater when things fall apart. That's life. And that's what we want. Edvard Munch's painting depicts the sense that this life that we're all seeking is actually under attack from something that we can't quite specify. But in this very long passage, Jesus has come to tell us what those adversaries are that's out to steal life from us. And more importantly, Jesus is here to tell us and to show us why taking cover in his identity is our protection against those adversaries. And the first of those adversaries is sin itself. Now, for context's sake, it's necessary to note that Jesus is not giving a lecture here. It's not a treatise. As you saw, it's a dialogue. It's a dialogue that turns into an argument with Jews who had at first begun to take him seriously at some level, but then who are now starting to take issue with him. And the one thread that you may have noticed that runs through the entirety of this text is the story of Abraham, which we have heard in various places throughout our service this morning. Jesus says in verse 31, "If you abide in my word, you're truly my disciples, you'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Now, you and I hear that phrase. Every time I hear it, I am transported to my college days in Austin. You go to the main building, and it is inscribed on the front facade of the main building. "You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." And when we hear that word, those profound, those poignant words, it's kind of like we want the music to start to swell and the doves to sort of just break forth, right? That's not how Jesus' conversation partners heard what he said. It fell like a thud. They're offended by what he said, not endeared. They say in verse 33, "We're offspring of Abraham. We've never been enslaved to anybody. How can you say we'll be free?" They're saying to him, "We've already made our covenant promise to Abraham. He's our promise. In what sense are we enslaved?" And if you want to kind of back up a little bit and kind of see what is it that they're really saying, what they're reflecting is a very pre-modern way of understanding what gives you a sound identity, what makes you right with the universe. They're saying, "I'm a descendant of Abraham, and as such, I have the commendation of God by virtue of that identity." It's that emphasis on their family, on their pedigree, that sets them apart as that place that they might take refuge. Their ancestry is their ticket, if you will. And that's why you will hear throughout the Old Testament, "What's your name?" Your name is always followed up by "son of this." So you'll hear Jacob, son of Isaac, Joseph, son of Jacob. It's why you will hear, even in modern cultures, that preserve this idea of what you find like in the Russian language, the patronymic. "What's your name?" Your middle name is actually derived from the first name of your father. Who you came from defines you, even down to the name that you have. Who you were descended from was big in the pre-modern world. Now, what's happened? What's changed? At least in Western societies, for a large part. Now it's no longer who your daddy was, unless your name was Rockefeller or Kennedy, for the most part. Now the acceptability of your identity boils down to your personal qualities, your aptitudes, your accomplishments. Who cares who your dad is, what your name is? What have you done? What have you done lately? That's who you are in the way we think of things in this day about identity. And what Jesus is saying to these Jews who are wrapping their identity in Abraham is just as applicable to we who might be tempted to wrap our identity in what we've done. And what Jesus is saying is this: neither who you descend from nor what you aspire to will ever immunize you against this thing called sin and its consequences. He says in verse 34, "Truly I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin." He's saying, no matter your background, no matter your resume, sin is part of you and a part of you that you can't shake by yourself, by some sort of trick or technique. In Scripture, at times, sin is likened to a debt that you incur. At other times, it's likened to a sickness that you're afflicted by. And with respect to ourselves or our identity, we are those whose relationship to sin is that of having a debt we can't pay and a sickness that we can't heal. That's how we have to understand ourselves. That's the truth about ourselves. And that's why it's rather sobering to hear what the psalmist says in Psalm 130 when he says, "If you, O Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand?" In other words, if you were to measure us against God's holiness, who would ever pass the test? The short answer is none. And with respect to the idea of sin's affliction over us, what does Paul say in Romans 7? Every time he has the option of doing the right thing, he feels something at work in him to drive him to do the exact opposite thing. It's always crouching at his door. Sin condemns us, sin follows us, and as the poem goes, it's like a devious tour guide who promises you a wonderful journey, but always takes you further than you thought you were going to go. It keeps you longer than you thought you were going to stay, and costs you much more than you thought you were going to pay. That's sin. Now, look, it's 2015. People don't talk about sin. We snicker at the word sin for the most part. And so these kinds of conclusions about the place of sin in us sound pretty dour. Are they true? Fine. You don't want to listen to Scripture? Listen to somebody named Stephen March. He wrote an article recently about the online world and how it would seem that social media has elicited from us and amplified in us some of the most dastardly behavior imaginable. Online, there's these thing called trolls. They're people that like to go and read stuff that other people say and then go into the comment boxes and try to rip them, tear them apart with utter impunity. He says in his article, given the pervasive incidence of online rage, he recognizes that we have, quote, an inherent capacity for monstrosity. It's not just learned. It's not just amplified. It's there. It's a latent quality that the online context seems to liberate in us like vinegar on baking soda. That inherent capacity for monstrosity might sound familiar. It's what you and I might like to call depravity. It's not just a bad habit. It's a quality. Now, what is the Apostle Paul's solution to that condition of an inherent capacity for monstrosity? Is it to work harder? Is it to pull yourself up by your bootstraps? Is it to get clean yourself? No. That's why he says at the end of chapter 7 of Romans, "Who will deliver me from this body of death?" The answer to the debt and sickness of our sin is Jesus. And the reason, therefore, that you and I can take refuge in his identity against the enslavement of sin is for this reason. By his death, as you know, your sin is pardoned. Full stop. No qualification. His death pays for your sin. But in Jesus also, your sin is finally seen for what it is, that you might be healed of it. It is exposed such that we come to see sin as sin. We see it as that futile attempt to get what we can want, but get what we can only get from God. We see sin finally as that initially delicious thing, which actually turns out to be a disastrous thing. If the debt of, look, back up for a second. If you sin against me, if you go to my wife and ask for forgiveness, that's nuts. You offended me. Why go to my wife to ask for forgiveness? It doesn't make sense. If you read Psalm 51, You know what David says about the ultimate consequence of our sin, or rather who we're ultimately sinning against when we sin against anybody. We're ultimately sinning against God. And therefore, while it is certainly proper to go to the person that you sinned, it is also necessary to go to the one whom you ultimately sinned, because every sin is deep down a mistrust of God's goodness. If the debt of sin can only be forgiven by the one against whom the sin is committed, then only the one who is God can forgive all that I've done that was ultimately a sinful mistrust in Him. That's why we take refuge in Jesus and not ourselves and our accomplishments. If the sickness of sin can only be remedied by one who fully understands and sympathizes with our condition, then only the one who is ultimately responsible for my existence can come to my aid. That's why we take refuge in His identity. It's in His identity, in His self, that ourselves can be pardoned and healed of our relationship to sin. That's the first occasion for taking cover in Him. The second is this. Verses 39 through 47 are perhaps some of the most jarring words that have ever come out of Jesus' mouth. These Jews had first been intrigued by Jesus, and then they were becoming incensed by Him, and now they're brooding on murderous thoughts toward Him. And while they're continuing to press the issue about their being children of Abraham, Jesus makes the most pointed claim about who they're really in league with. Look one more time at verse 39. If you're Abraham's children, you would be doing the works Abraham did. But now you seek to kill me, a man who has told you the truth that I heard from God. It's not what Abraham did. You're doing the works your father did. And then when they retort with the claim that God is their father, Jesus plays His full hand. If God were your father, He says in verse 42, you would love me, for I came from God. Why do you not understand what I say? It's because you cannot bear to hear my word. You are of your father, the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires. Wow. Jesus ascribes to their intentions a satanic congruence. Now, I'm going to do a sidebar here that's necessary, because neither passages nor sermons exist in a vacuum. Jesus is speaking into His moment. But I need to put these words in the context of our moment, because look, there have been essays and articles and books written on these words, and specifically about whether they are words that breed anti-Semitic violence. Maybe you saw this week the speech of the impassioned French foreign minister before the French parliament. He calls out, he decries, and he demands an end to the existence of real and rampant anti-Semitism, both in France and throughout Europe, that is certainly indubitably on the rise. And so when Jesus here seems to equate these Jews' intentions with satanic designs, the question that many people have raised, is He provoking the kind of anti-Semitism that you see perhaps even in the words of Martin Luther towards the end of his life? Yes, that's for another sermon. What is the answer to the claim that Jesus, or at least John's representation of Jesus, was a seedbed for anti-Semitism? I'll give you four responses that say that's not a fair reading of what he's saying. One, Jesus is a Jew. For him to be anti-Semitic would be bizarre. Two, Jesus' condemnation of these Jews was not for their being Jews, but for their interest in having Him killed, which is what Satan would want. Thirdly, what Jesus does in the garden at His arrest, what does He do when the apostle Peter strikes the high priest's official on the ear? What does Jesus say? Put your sword away. Such that even in Matthew 26, he says, all who take the sword shall perish by the sword. So whatever his ascription of satanic interest to these Jews, it was not sanctioning of violence toward them. So anybody that calls out Jesus as warrant for violence against Jews would not be walking in league with Jesus, but would actually be walking in league with Satan. Fourth, for him to call it a satanic plot is not so much to argue that these Jews were colluding with the adversary. It's rather to say that their actions are essentially indistinguishable from what Satan would want to do. Brothers and sisters, you know what happened in the garden, but what happened on the way to the Garden of Gethsemane? What does he say to Peter? Get behind me, Satan. Is Jesus being anti-Semitic to address Peter that way? No. Is Jesus saying that Peter was possessed of the devil? No. Neither Peter nor these men seeking his life were any more possessed by the devil than the men who beheaded those Coptic Christians on the beach of Libya last week. And yet, they both sought to do precisely what Jesus' adversary sought to do. End of sidebar. Jesus is saying he is a refuge against the lies of the devil. And the question we want to ask is, how so? If he says in verse 44 that the devil has been a murderer from the beginning, and that when he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he is a liar and the father of lies, we have to ask, what are the lies that you and I are most prone to hear, which Jesus is most able to counter? It's two kinds of lies. One involves seduction, and the other involves accusation. It's a lie to entertain the notion that whatever might offend God or diminish your relationship with Him is no big deal, or that it's only your imagination. Every time you've sinned, something has whispered in your ear to say, it's going to be okay. Don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. And it's a lie. It's a lie when you come to believe that it doesn't matter, and the adversary lies that way. And then should you bite on that first lie, a second lie is close at hand. The second lie says this, that after the seduction, there's an accusation, and that accusation says, it's an irredeemable situation. You're done. You might as well give up on this because he's going to give up on you. It's hopeless. You're worthless. That's the second kind of lie. It's a cunning, it's an effective, and it's a destructive lie, and it's all a lie. And brothers and sisters, we believe them both. They don't just walk through our brain, they seize them. They hold them hostage. What helps? The reason that we can take cover in the identity of Jesus against the lies of the devil is that he's not just the one who speaks the truth of God. He speaks the truth in love. He said in verse 42, if God were your father, you would love me, for I came from God and am here. What he means is to know him is to love him, and to know him is to know that he loves you. So he is not just some sort of placard that says, this is what is holy. Jesus is the one who cups your face in his hands, like a father cups his child's hand in his face, and tells you what is true out of love for you. He warns you by what is seductive, by showing what he has for you is really of love. And then should you fail him, he is the same one who holds your face in his hand and he rebukes you. But it's a rebuke in love that says, I adjure you by the living God that this is a way to perdition, but I shall be with you and I shall not cast you off. The cross is more than enough evidence of his love, love that aims to wave off the seduction and love that aims to punch a hole in the accusation. That's why we take cover in him. We take cover in the self of Jesus against the lying designs of the devil. But there's one more. Beyond sin, beyond deceit, there's one more adversary that does most to afflict us, and it's this. It's against the fear of death that we all have. I'm not going to develop this too much because we're going to come back to this on Easter Sunday when we talk about Jesus saying, I am the resurrection and the life. But in verse 51, he says, look, with all candor and confidence, truly I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death. He's saying in so many words that to let your identity be formed by his identity is to have both your understanding and your experience of death transformed. Death looms over every single one of you, but it will loom differently in him. It looms over us all. It looms larger whenever those we love or even we ourselves are drawing near to it. If you read this week's backstory, then you know that I am drawing near to death as I am caring for my father who went on hospice this week, which is not unique to me. Many of you in this room are facing it in a different way, but we're all facing it. And as his day looms larger, I am tempted to conclude what I read from James Baldwin this week. A friend of mine gave me a quote from James Baldwin. He was that author and activist back in the 1960s. And of his words and of death, he said this: life is tragic simply because the earth turns and the sun inexorably rises and sets. And one day, for each of us, the sun will go down for the last time. Perhaps the whole root of our trouble, the human trouble, is that we will sacrifice all the beauty of our lives, will imprison ourselves in all manner of things in order to deny the fact of death, the only fact we have. If I'm only to stare at the story of death that's unfolding before me, then I might rightly conclude that death is the only fact we have. But brothers and sisters, that is not the only story to which we have access. We've been made aware of a story in which the one who died, as we will all die, rose again. A death that he foretold, a death that he endured, and a death that he overcame. And so the reason we take refuge against the unmitigated fear of death is that death did not hold him who entered willingly into it. As William Temple put it, the claim that if a man observe his word, he shall be freed from death is the claim of a fanatic or a lunatic. Unless it is true. Jesus is making these claims about himself, brothers and sisters, so that we might find our identity in his. But why can he make that claim? Abraham is the other personage in this whole text that runs its way through the entirety of it. And that's for a reason. Because when push comes to shove and the Jews that are present start to antagonize Jesus for claiming to have a certain understanding of Abraham, Jesus makes the most audacious claim of all in verse 58. Truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. Jesus is saying about himself that he is temporally prior to Abraham and that he is singularly related to God. Now, brothers and sisters, anybody else says that? They're nuts. A certifiable megalomaniac. But if that's true about him, what is to account for the rest of his wisdom? And if that statement is just an embellishment on John's part, left to the early church's imagination, why would so many end up worshiping this Jesus and dying for him? Not killing for him, but dying for him. The reason he can pardon and heal us from sin, the reason he can turn back lies that go to our souls, the reason he can rescue us from death is that he was here long before Abraham and so long that he's been here with God because he is God. That's why. And that's why we take cover in him. But how do you do that? Let me finish with a brief comment about how. How precisely do we take cover in him? You may have noticed it. It's kind of subtle, but it's a pretty consistent marker throughout all three parts of this long passage. Whether he's talking about taking cover against sin, the devil, or the fear of death, there is one consistent tool by which we may take cover. And that's in his word. You can go back later, but in all three segments of the passage, he's either saying abide in his word, hear his word, or keep his word. And if you want to synthesize all three of those phrases into one, F.D. Bruner could do a lot worse when he says, you need to make your home in his word. You need to dwell there. You need to stick there. It's a matter of persevering in it, both personally and corporately. It means doing the work yourself, and it means doing the work corporately and collaboratively in the church. It's letting the word confront you and destabilize you and confound you and hopefully also encourage and steel you. It's by attending to what Jesus has said and done in his word that gets us to what C.S. Lewis said in the rest of that quote on the front of your bulletin. Listen there as we close. He says, there must be a real giving up of the self. You must throw it away blindly, so to speak. Christ will indeed give you a real personality, but you must go not to him for the sake of that. As long as your own personality is what you're bothering about, you're not going to him at all. The very first step is to try to forget about the self altogether. Your real new self, which is Christ's and also yours and yours just because it is his, will not come as long as you're looking for it. It will come when you are looking for him. Making your home in his word is taking your eyes off yourself so that you get a new self. Brothers and sisters, what can you do with the remainder of your 40 days to wrestle with what he said? If you're not wrestling, if you're not in some senses offended by what he said, you're not listening. There's probably stuff that he said that you either don't get or don't agree with, and I would love to go to lunch with you about that stuff because I probably wrestle with it too. But brothers and sisters, the life, this life is going to make you scream. But by the one who is before Abraham and is with God, we're going to find ourselves because we'll find him. In the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, amen.